This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. On today's roundtable, a slavery museum is asked to give back donations from a tobacco company, and illiteracy is a growing problem in the nation's capital. Joining today's panel are political consultant Walter Fields, economist and author Julianne Malveaux, the president and CEO of Last Word Productions Incorporated, and Ron Christie, VP of the lobbying firm DC Navigators and former special assistant to President George W. Bush. So welcome, everybody, and let's talk about smoking and how dollars flow into African-American organizations. So an anti-smoking group wants the U.S. National Slavery Museum to give back the money donated by tobacco powerhouse Philip Morris. The campaign for tobacco-free kids played on the relative nature of the museum by saying the tobacco company targets children for, quote, another form of slavery. The president of the organization said the museum's association with the largest cigarette manufacturer in the U.S. works against the museum's purpose. Now, Julianne, there has been a lot of tobacco money flowing to African-American or African-American-themed organizations. Number one, is this a fair demand? And number two, what about the language of the demand?
Well, Farai, I think I said a couple of weeks ago on the show that money and back are two words that an economist does not use in the same sentence. No, they shouldn't give the money back. Quite frankly, most cynically, I would see this as some form of reparation. Slaves smoked. Tobacco industry basically built its back on the on slave labor and on post-Reconstruction labor. This is a modest investment in something that's important and national. And no, I don't think it should be given back. And I think that these folks have some issues in the way that they are dealing with black people, because part of a dialogue would be a dialogue about respect. Now, in terms of the smoking money that comes into our organizations, I would look at it a little bit more carefully. When you see sports, a run or something that's supported by a tobacco company, you do kind of have to look askance at some of that. But the fact is that African-American consumers spend money on tobacco, they spend money on alcohol, they spend money on a lot of things that aren't good for them, and this is just a way of some of that money flowing back into our community.
Walter, I read an analysis that said, well, hey, if folks in the black community are going to take tobacco money and alcohol money, at least get more of it, and looking at the relative size of the donations. Are you with Julianne saying, look, take the money and run? Are you someone who wants to look at the amount of the money, or are you someone who thinks this money should not be flowing to this organization?
Well, I have a personal attachment to this story, and I would hope that they would give it back. My father died 36 years ago as a heavy smoker, tobacco-related cancer. My great-grandmother picked tobacco in North Carolina and died from a heart attack with her granddaughter at her side. That granddaughter was my mother. So I have always had an issue with the tobacco industry, and I think that what they have done cleverly is they have seeded our organizations to minimize the debate of the damage that they do, not only upon blacks, but upon all Americans, because smoking is truly one of the deadliest forms of entertainment that Americans partake in. And when you look at the deviousness of this industry, the fact that they outright lied, the fact that they concealed the dangers of this very dangerous product for decades, I would hope that this museum, because since it isn't a lot of money, would give it back and look for some other sources that might be more aligned with the whole vision of that museum.
Ron, Julianne mentioned slaves smoked, I mean, but slaves also picked tobacco for free. I mean, tobacco plantations were part of the great economic tapestry of slavery. How do you fall down on this issue?
I tend to fall down on this the same way that Julianne does. I absolutely agree with Walter that the tobacco industry has used some terrible tactics over the years to target children and to target individuals who had no right or no business smoking. But I happen to represent an entity out in Cincinnati, Ohio, called the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center, a museum that looks at the Underground Railroad movement and the contemporary slavery that goes on around the world. And I can tell you from firsthand experience, it's very difficult to raise money from state and federal sources, and it's very difficult to receive money from financial institutions and other corporate donors who want to participate. And if a tobacco manufacturer in the Commonwealth of Virginia wants to contribute to a slavery museum, a very important message and a very important aspect of our American history here in America and in Virginia, I say, let's take that money. But at the same time, I think that group needs to take its fight in other means and other manners, and trying to cut off resources in a very difficult fundraising climate, I think, is the wrong way to do it.
I'm going to go back to you, Walter, because obviously you have a very moving and very important personal story. What can be done if you think that this money should not flow to this organization? What can be done to find other contributors that you think would be more aligned with the mission?
Well, I think that's a marketing challenge on the part of the museum. And I think if we look at the tobacco industry, you know, if they really want to make a contribution, make it towards a health care fund to individuals who've been damaged by tobacco. You know, there are some meaningful ways that this industry could provide a valuable service to society. And I think what they do by making these type of contributions, I think tongue-in-cheek they say we're with you, but we also want to make sure that we cover our you-know-what because we understand the damage we've done to the very community that we now claim that we support. So I think for the museum and other black museums across the country, I understand the difficulty of fundraising, but at some point in time, you have to ask yourself, are you sort of defeating your own purposes here when you begin to accept money from sources that clearly have been aligned against the very community you purport to represent. And I think it handicaps us in a way of telling the whole story. Let's tell the whole story. You know, perhaps maybe the contribution should come with the caveat that you have to tell the whole story about tobacco and how slave labor was used picking tobacco for free as part of the museum's exhibit. I'd like to see how that story is told before they take this contribution.
All right.
Well, I would agree with that last point that Walter made, but I don't, you know, the responsibility that exists in our community is to educate our young people and our adults about healthy living. If you go on these people's websites, they may be as horrible as they want to be, and I would add that many of them are and have outright lied, but what they do now by law and by interest is talk about the danger of smoking on their own website. So the question is, where are we? You know, we can't cough our way certainly to freedom, but we've got to raise some of the questions about these lifestyles, and many of the people who are leaders look at their own lifestyles and the examples that they're putting out there.
All right, I want to move on from this topic, but before I do, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to NPR's News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We have just been hearing from economist and author Julianne Malveaux, the president and CEO of Last Word Productions Incorporated, political consultant Walter Fields, and Ron Christie, the VP of the lobbying firm DC Navigators and former special assistant to President George W. Bush. Ron, you are in DC. DC Navigators, all that.
I am.
Illiteracy. About a third of people living in the nation's capital are functionally illiterate compared to a fifth of the U.S. population. A fifth is pretty bad. A third is horrible. Those numbers come from a report from the U.S. Department of Education. And their definition of someone who's functionally illiterate is somebody who has trouble doing things like understanding bus schedules, reading maps, filling out job applications. There's an issue with, you know, new immigrants who are still learning English, but there's also plenty of people who were born and raised in the U.S. who are functionally illiterate. Is this a crisis for the American economy as well as, I guess, the American soul or spirit?
Yes, it's absolutely a crisis for the American competitiveness, I think. I've lived in the Washington, D.C. area for the past 16 years now. And when I worked on Capitol Hill, I had the privilege of being a mentor in a program called HOST, Help One Student to Succeed. And this program looked at Title I very poor children in the Washington, D.C. school district system. And they decided to provide mentors and tutoring and really the educational tools that these students needed to succeed in society. Unfortunately, this is a very, very small portion of the people in the district who are receiving this form of tutoring and this form of assistance. And I think what we've seen over the years is that there are so many students and so many elderly people in the District of Columbia who need these very important tools to remain competitive, to apply for a job, to compete in the American society. And the thing that's the most distressing about this to me, Farai, is the fact that per capita, the federal government spends more money per student in the District of Columbia than in the other 50 states. So I think the system is broken. I'm pleased that the new mayor who came into Washington, Mr. Fenty, has decided to tackle the education problem. And my goodness, if we can't protect our children and give them the tools and the assets that they need to compete, then you're going to have yet another generation that is going to be stuck and mired in poverty and in low-income situations.
Now, Julianne, you also live in D.C. You're not in D.C. today, but Washington is one of those many cities where there are essentially two groups of students. There are people who have to fight to get a decent education in the public school system, and then there are people who, for various reasons, have choice about where they send their kids. And this is about adult illiteracy, but these adults were children once. What can be done to make sure that the people who rely on the public school systems actually have some options?
If I were superintendent of D.C. schools, I would burn down every one of them and start over, frankly. You have a physical plant that's corrupting and corrosive. I knew that Ron was going to mention the per capita. He mentions the per capita, but he doesn't mention the long history. They've never had enough money to physically fix the infrastructure. You have schools with mold. One of our best high schools, Duke Ellington, which is our high school for the arts, the dance studio for a period of several months was warped, so the young women were basically practicing in the foyer. Of the school. You could go down the list. There's a young man who just wrote a piece in the Washington Post that would have moved you, a 16-year-old with a B-plus average from the hood, who said there's a piece of legislation called No Child Left Behind, but this economy has left my school and my neighborhood behind. And I think that that's just a powerful kind of statement. You know, we basically need to have schools that look like the best office buildings we have in our country, the best museums, the best anything that we have. And there's no collective will for it. If you go out to a suburb, you will find decent-looking schools. The school crisis is an inner-city crisis. It's a black and brown crisis, and it's a crisis of racism and neglect. And the intermediaries are these superintendents and teachers, but they're intermediaries. They're not the ones in charge. We could get all those people to Iraq in 5 minutes, but we could not get these schools fixed in years, in a period of years. And with the adult illiteracy, I mean, you've got it compounded in any number of ways. Mentoring is wonderful. It's an individual solution. But structurally, when our country values education as much as we value something like our aggressiveness in the world or some of the subsidies that we give to Halliburton, when we decide to do that, that's when we'll clean up schools.
Walter?
Well, you know, I work in a city with the largest public school district in the nation, and I come from a state with the longest-running school finance equity case on the books. And I think the problem here is that we have not invested properly in early childhood education. So these young people grow up, and they do become functional illiterates. And it's not just Washington, D.C. You can go to almost any major urban center. And it's a problem that is not necessarily confined to urban centers because it is creeping now into the suburbs. I live in a predominantly white suburban community. The problem we have in that community is one of tracking, putting black students in special education. They do not get the same level of education as their white counterparts. Therefore, they graduate from these pristine suburban school districts with the same problems as kids in urban school districts. We've got an education crisis in this country. The fact that we have devalued education, not just on the physical plant side, but actually interventions and what actually work. So kids are going to not only run down schools, they're going to schools with the most inexperienced teachers in the classroom who aren't capable of teaching them. We have an education establishment that looks the other way because they're more concerned about their contract than they are about the welfare of our children. So, you know, this problem has multiple layers. And if we finally start addressing it, there will be some hard truths that we're going to have to be willing to take on.
All right. Well, this is a topic that I care deeply about, but there's one more thing that I have to get to. It's pretty phenomenal and devastating. So the collapsing housing market has been really ripping Detroit apart. In the Motor City, you can find a home for less than you'd pay for a Cadillac. And at a recent auction in the city, 16 homes sold for $30,000 or less. Now, the tracking service Realty Track revealed that Detroit has about 14% unemployment and a third of the population lives in poverty, and the city leads the nation in foreclosures. So while the president has talked about an ownership society, what does it mean if the equity that you've really tried to gather in your home is completely undermined by the economic slump in your area? Ron?
I think Detroit is a tragic example of what happens when one particular city or geographic area relies so much on one line of commerce, and I'm talking about the auto industry. Over the last 30 years, the city of Detroit has lost more than half of its population. Crime continues to grow in that city. I think there's a certain sense of hopelessness in Detroit, and I just don't know what we can do in that particular city other than provide job training skills and to retrain some of these workers who were in the auto manufacturing field to compete. But looking very briefly at what you said about the President's Ownership Society, I think since 2001, it's largely been a success. You have the highest rate of African-American home ownership in American history right now, same with Hispanic. The president has fought very diligently to try to increase the number of Americans in general and minorities in particular to own a piece of that American dream. But looking at Detroit and looking at many other urban and, frankly, rural areas around the country, we need to make sure that our workers have the most best education and the best skills to compete in the workforce so that they can have that American dream.
Ryan, you needn't jump so quickly to defend the president's so-called ownership society. The fact is that the percentage increase for African-American and Latinos has been minimal. There's been a whole lot of lip service, and HUD has a great website, but the fact is that not much has been done here. And when you combine the focus on ownership with predatory lending, the fact of the matter is you have seen more and more African-American households and Latino households taken to get advantage of by this predatory lending and by lack of knowledge, which this HUD program says it's trying to fix. But we go to Detroit for Ryan. It's not even the cost of a Cadillac, it's the cost of a used Cadillac, which makes it even worse. I mean, there are certain areas where clearly you've seen property values decline, and it's partially a function. The fact that we don't do any kind of industrial planning or policy, we've seen Detroit year after year since Coleman Young became mayor, actually, which really raises a question about some of the things that caused Detroit's decline. I mean, some of them were certainly industrial divestment, but you also have an element of clear and plain racism in some of the decisions that were made in Detroit. So we can't forget about that.
Okay, Walter, you got a minute.
This is a scam. This is about an industry that preyed upon the most vulnerable. It has nothing to do with the local economy per se. It's not a Detroit story. It's a national story. We're going to find out that we're going to have thousands of particularly black and Latino homeowners who are going to lose their homes because they were given mortgages at rates that they cannot sustain. And now they're going to have difficulty holding on to those properties. It's going to turn out to be another mini SNL scandal in that the most vulnerable Americans are going to be the ones that are hit hardest. And what we need to do is really look at this whole issue of home ownership, because while I agree that home ownership should be the goal, not everyone is positioned to own a home. And we've got to get out of this notion that, you know, you buy a home. We created these scam mortgages, and now people are trapped and have no recourse, and they're going to lose everything.
All right, Walter, we're going to leave it there. Good topic to revisit later. Political consultant Walter Fields in our New York bureau, and Ron Christie of DC Navigators, plus economist Julianne Malveaux. Ron was in our DC headquarters, Julianne, Greensboro, North Carolina. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks, Farai.
And next on News and Notes, NPR's Juan Williams and guests tell us what's up on Capitol Hill on our Political Corner segment. Plus, we bust open the mailbag to read your letters.